Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for the podcast version of Trey's Variety Hour is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Okay, I've got a bad internet situation, everybody. I apologize. My name is Trey. Welcome to the Hangout. This is going to be very cool. This is an area I know very little about, space photography. And our special guest tonight is Ron Garand, the famous NASA astronaut who has amassed more than 1 million followers, maybe the most followed astronaut ever. So that's really exciting. We're all happy to have him, and we also have invited a ton of great space photographers, all kind of land-based people like me that just dream of the things Ron can do, and everyone's going to be sharing their space photos and talking about it, asking tech questions and art questions, just kind of loosely hanging out. And I apologize for my situation. If I drop out, I put Gordon Lang in charge of taking this thing over. I was just out. I'm in Santa Cruz right now, and I was out shooting a sunset, and I thought I would have good bandwidth, but I stopped in this cafe that's full of, well, there's a lot of different kind of people here. And I want to know that just if I drop, I'm sorry. Gordon will take over, and we'll just keep on going. Jim Goldstein has joined us. So let's start with introductions. No one man is any more important than any other one man, even though I wish we had a few gals in here to class it up a little bit. So sorry about that, the viewing audience. Let's start with Ron and say hello to him. Hello, Ron.
Hey, Trey. Thanks for having me. I'm a little bit out of place here because I'm the only real amateur photographer amongst the group. So.
Now, tell us about this tour you just got back from. You were over in Europe talking to students and stuff, right?
Well, I just got back from D.C., but the week before that I was in England. And, we were traveling around talking to mostly students, but we also did a TED Talk out there in Salford Keys, just next to Manchester. But like I said, we just got back from D.C. A couple days ago where we were giving presentations and having some meetings up on the Hill and things like that.
Well, that's cool. You say you're an amateur, but, I mean, we all envy you like crazy.
I've had some good opportunities.
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't want this to turn into one of those, that Chris Farley skit, Saturday Night Live, where he has famous actors on. He says, remember that movie you did? That was awesome. That's kind of what I feel like. let's say hi to Jim Goldstein. Hello, Jim. How are you?
How's it going?
Good. So tell people about yourself and tell them about your website and that sort of thing.
Okay, sure. So as you know now, I'm Jim Goldstein, and I run a blog called jmg-galleries.com. I'm a full-time professional photographer based out of San Francisco. Just got done releasing an ebook on basically shooting time. It includes star trails and a lot of astrophotography type stuff, and just out there to inspire people. So just love photography, love talking about it, so I appreciate the invite.
Sure. Here is your book. Let me go ahead and show this to people, because I think everyone loves space photography in it. This is over at flatbooks.com. It's called Photographing in the Fourth Dimension, and it's a wonderful book by Jim. Everyone that reads it loves it, and if you want to learn more about how to take photos like that, Jim is a great teacher, and it's highly recommended. So thanks for writing that, Jim. That thing is awesome.
Thanks. Thanks for referring it.
Oh, well, sure. Of course, no problem. Let me see. Who's next? How about just randomly? Let's just go left to right now. Hello, Ben.
Hey, guys. My name is Ben Canales, and I'm a landscape astrophotographer, kind of an obsessive hobbyist that is now slowly becoming a full-time thing, so I'm really excited about that. I've been doing it for a little over 3 years now, originally from the East Coast where light pollution is terrible, and moved out here to Oregon in the Pacific Northwest, and the discovery of the stars and the chance to take photos of them has just been fantastic.
Cool. Nice to meet you. Now, Brad.
Hey, guys. Thank you again, Trey, for having us and putting this all together. My name's Brad Goldpaint. You can find my work at goldpaintphotography.com. I just recently moved to Bend, Oregon, and starting in about 2-3 weeks, I'm going to start offering workshops to take people out and show them about how to photograph the night sky and take advantage of all the areas around Oregon. So really looking forward to that. I fell in love with the night sky when I hiked half of the Pacific Crest Trail a few years back, and been shooting the night sky ever since.
Awesome. Okay, and now you, Daryl. Hello, Daryl.
How you doing? It's an honor to be here. Was really pumped when I heard that you were having Ron Duran on here. That's awesome. Seen some of his shots during the early days. Anyways, Daryl Van Gaal, I very much call myself an amateur photographer. Only been into photography itself, where I got serious about a little less than a year ago. Started at the same time with astrophotography. I've always had a love of the stars, so I wound up getting a very small apochromatic triplet telescope. It's total of, I think, about 480 millimeters of focal length, and started doing deep sky photography of the deep space objects. Last few weeks I've been trying to get some star trails, some more wide field stuff, but it's very location specific. I'm in not too bad of an area, but some of the pictures that the other people here in the hangout have are just amazing. I'm getting the opportunity in a few months to head up to Northern Ontario, which is actually on the Google light pollution map as a totally clear sky, so I'm really looking forward to that. So it's actually during a new moon cycle as well, so
even better.
Cool. And in the Foursquare is the newly unbearded Dave Beffer, my excellent producer in Parspatu. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Trey. Everybody can find me at plusdave.com, and that's pretty much it.
All right. Thank you for helping me put this together. You know, when I put up a post earlier this week, I said, does anyone know interesting space photographers? We've got so many suggestions. And I really had trouble deciding, so Dave helped out with it. I got assembled this amazing crew, so thank you, Dave.
No problem.
And now Gordon. Hello, Gordon.
Hello, Trey. Thanks for having me. My name's Gordon. I'm not worthy. I'm so excited to be on this hangout. I follow all of you guys, and when Trey and Dave were saying, oh, can you pick out a guy who does this, or a guy or girl who does this style of photography, I was like, how about this one? No, we've got him on the show. How about this one? No, we've got him on the show. So I'm really excited to meet all you guys. And I think, this book says it all. I'm a bit of a fan. I don't know if you've got one of these. This is, I'll be tucking in on this during during today's live. And it's also, I have to say, it's such an honor because it's so convenient as well, because I've never managed to nail that lunch with an astronaut at Kennedy Space Center. This is even better. So I'm really pleased. The reason I'm here professionally, hopefully, is I run a site called CameraLabs.com. My job is to review digital cameras. This week's camera is the Canon G1X, which is their first portable camera with a large sensor. And immediately after this hangout, I'm going to be posting some high ISO comparisons for this. So if you're interested in this camera and how it compares to a smaller sensor or a DSLR, you can check that out. In terms of astrophotography, that's what actually got me into photography in the first place. I inherited my dad's SLR camera when I was only about 12, 13 years old. And the first thing I did was point it straight upwards into the night sky and do long exposures and infuriate my mom, who just wanted pictures of my sister and the family. And instead I was saying, look, Mom, more little lines and dots. And she wasn't that excited, but it formed the man you see before you today. So it's a pleasure to be here.
Cool. Nice to see you. And last is Randy. Hi, Randy. Randy, can you hear me over? You might be muted. So click the little unmute thing on top of the Hangout so we can hear you. Can you hear us? Uh-oh. Well, he's having a few difficulties. So that's okay. He'll come back online here. Let's. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yep. You're starting to break up a little bit, but you're okay.
All right. Well, let me first start by asking Ron a question, and then you can use this really kind of awful question as just a bad to show some of your photos. But actually, this is sort of a serious question. We've seen space photos our whole lives, all being like, you know, space nuts. But there's something about your photos where they're quite artistic, right? There's something else happening here. Because, you know, everyone goes up there and they take these sort of standard photos and you're cool in space and it's inspiring and stuff. But there's something else about your photos. I don't know if it's the composition or the subject matter or what it is about you. But have you thought about this artistic side, or why are your photos so different and so interesting?
Well, one of the things, you know, people ask me if I had any surprises on my spaceflight. And I think one of the big surprises was how much I enjoy taking still photos. And I've always been kind of a video guy, and I imagined that I was going to take, you know, all these videos and tell the story that way. But when I, you know, we've got these amazing cameras up there. We got D3S and the D2XS. And on my first flight, we didn't have those cameras. And I think that's why I kind of assumed I'd be a video guy. But when I first started taking these pictures and I saw how well they captured the view, because it's very frustrating to look out the window and see this amazing sight and not be able to share it. And for the first time, I was able to share this. I took the picture and say, wow, that's really what it looks like. That camera did a really good job at capturing that. And so I got really excited about that, and I completely shifted gears and became a still photographer versus a videographer. And when I saw how well the cameras captured the image, then I started to try and catch the emotion of what I was seeing. And what I definitely didn't want to do is be a satellite, you know, a satellite imagery. we have humans up there to share the experience. And so, when we saw, you know, certain shadows being cast on the horizon by the thunderstorms, you know, as the sun was setting, and, you know, you feel, that's an emotional thing to see. And so really all I did was, you know, point these amazing cameras out the window and try and capture what I was feeling. And most of what for me put emotion in the picture was the horizon and making sure that the horizon was in the view and not just straight on necessarily, but in such an angle that it gave you the impression that you weren't looking down at the Earth, you were looking at a planet hanging in the blackness of space. A little slice of it, because we're not far enough out to see the whole round Earth, but a little slice of the Earth, but to definitely give you that feeling that there's a universe behind it, and it's just floating in the middle of the universe. So that was the objective. And the other, you know, the really big thing is, you know, we took so many pictures that, you know, I think I took over 25,000 pictures during my 5.5 months on this mission. And when you take that many pictures, occasionally you get it right. So some of the pictures turned out all right.
Yeah, turned out right. That's a little bit of an understatement. we're all in shock. You're just listening to talk, Ron. Took a little bit to register that line.
Hey, Ron, can I ask you a question about taking photos through windows?
Sure.
I mean, I think probably all of us here and everyone watching is taking photos through windows. There's some fantastic views on the top of big buildings and things. Not quite as good as the view you have at the ISS, but the big challenge that we have is that there's all these reflections, internal lights. You've got this, you know, single or double pane of glass. Now, according to my NASA Space Shuttle manual, I think your windows might be triple glazed and each pane is half an inch thick. It must be an absolute
steady, whereas the lights close to you will have the blur to it, and it actually gives a nice effect to the picture because it shows the motion a little bit. And then when you time lapse that, it all evens out. So you see the steady lights all of a sudden start to streak out, and that again is a really kind of cool effect.
Yeah, Ron, I was wondering kind of the same thing. How you tested all these shots, because I'm sitting there on my tripod, I'm looking at my camera, and I got to take hundreds of photos to get this exposure just right so there's not enough streaks in the Milky Way and vice versa. And I'm wondering how you're controlling that and how many takes it took you to figure out this right exposure time, because I'm assuming the video that we're seeing that you did, I'm sure that had to have taken, what, dozens of tries at least, right?
Yeah, it's just trial and error, and the thing about it is all the time lapse that you see. I know that all the ones that I took and all the ones that Mike Fossen took. I don't know if the guys on board now are the same way. All of those are in manual setting, and the reason for that is when you put it on automatic, it would change too much, and it would really give a bad effect to the time lapse. And so we would basically just take a couple of practice shots, get it to the way we liked it, and then just start, you know, cranking them out, like either once every second, once every 3 seconds. But you get what you get at that point, and they worked out pretty good. And even when the sun starts to rise and it changes, you know, the whole exposure change, it actually gives a good effect because you do get this blossoming, and they're terrible pictures, but from a video point of view, it's pretty spectacular as the sun comes up and then you see this sun bloom. And what I would do is I'd stop it, you know, reset the camera on a different, obviously a different manual setting, and then start taking them again, and it seemed to work out.
Absolutely. Seemed to work out. That's an understatement.
Oh, man.
Ron, when you go on a holiday to somewhere like, say, you know, if I was to go to the Grand Canyon, I'd come home, and it would be a big trip. I'd come home, I'd go, oh, no, I wish I'd done that. I wish I'd remembered to do that. Do you have any feelings like that where you thought you came back down into Earth and you were like, oh, man, there was that one shot I really wanted to get and I didn't nail it. Maybe it was a time lapse. Maybe it was a specific country. Or maybe, you know, sometimes you forget you have a certain lens with you and you thought, oh, that would have been, I wish I'd got the picture of that lake with that lens. Do you have any regrets like that?
As far as I know, I haven't taken a picture of Mount Everest. So I was trying to do that. The Great Wall, I didn't get a picture of that. But what I really kind of am sorry about is it was probably a month before I was set to return to Earth when I figured out the time lapse stuff. You know, we got a message from the ground suggesting that we do the time lapse. You know, we had all been taught how to do it, but I never really attempted it because I thought it was going to be too hard. But it really was honestly very, very easy to do. Once you got the camera settings correct, you know, it was fairly simple to do, and then we had some really simple software with a push of a button. We'd stitch it together into a video, and it was kind of amazing. The first night, you know, it was after bedtime, and I tried this, and I downloaded it into my computer, and I was just amazed. And actually, the first one I ever did, I used, and I don't know if you guys have seen it, but I put together this time-lapse to Peter Gabriel's Down to Earth, and the opening scene of that is the first attempt that I ever did on a time lapse. And so, you know, here I am in my crew quarters. I'm supposed to be asleep about 3 hours before I get this thing down, and I get all excited, and then I see the little button that says set to music. So I set it to music, and then as soon as everybody woke up the next morning, I pulled everybody to a computer and said, hey guys, you got to see this. This is just amazing. And the crew member, like Mike Fossen, the guys on board now, Don Pettit and Dan Burbank, you know, they've definitely taken it to the next level and really perfected some of it. Because again, we didn't realize how simple it was to do that, to get really good right off the bat images and stitch them together in this time lapse. And again, what it does really well is tell the story and capture the emotion. You know, when you put motion into the equation, and especially this low light type of photography, you know, that for the first time was like, okay.
I thought you were actually going to take us with you, but I heard that. My apologies. What would you do differently this time?
I would have taken a lot more time lapse. I would be doing a lot more bracketing, so I could do some HDR stuff. I guess you guys know better than I do, but there's a lot of ways you can take pictures that will lend themselves to post processing. Which I didn't do because I really wasn't aware of that. So there's, I think things like that. I would experiment a lot more with bracketing techniques and things like that. Because it is really tough. It's really tough in space to get the right exposure.
Jim, you look like you had a question earlier. Jim, you're muted. Still can't hear you.
Do they want to read lips?
Jim, did you mute yourself or something in the Hangout? The little microphone on top, is it red?
Oh. So I just
thought... Ron, it looks like you should... Yeah, tell us about this photo.
Well, this is... it was just this little sliver of the moon that was illuminated. Just as the sun was setting, the moon was setting, and so I got... It was in a really good place at the right time, and... This is one of my favorite shots because it really captures a lot of different effects, and it gives you the just by looking at the picture, you know where the sun is, and it just kind of puts everything in perspective: the sun, the moon, the earth, and the sunset. So it's one of the ones I kind of like.
I love those Earthshine shots. Nice. I don't show any pictures now. I had an Earthshine one, but I'm just not going to bother now.
I love that you're doing this on your free time in between tasks. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah. Now, you guys are all doing your time lapse and stuff at night. Do you not find, like, whenever I go out and do some astro shots, I'm shot the next day? I mean, I'm so tired because I've been up all night. Well, I'm a little bit worried that, Ron's supposed to be sleeping, and ready for his mission, and he's out taking photos all night. He goes, hey, guys, look at these awesome pictures I got last night. It didn't compromise the mission, did it, Ron?
No, Gordon, we get 16 nights a day. So, we could be taking night shots as we're eating lunch. So.
Oh, wow.
Hey,
How long are those night periods as you're rotating around?
Well, normally 45 minutes of light, 45 minutes of daytime, but it depends on the time of year. And so usually we're in a lot more periods of light than we are of daytime. And there's periods during the orbit where it just doesn't work. When we're in the sunshine and the Earth is in the darkness, you can't take pictures of the Earth. It just doesn't work. So there's a lot of timing that goes into it. I think I got another picture I wanted to show you. This, let's see. Can you guys see this one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what I like about this one is, because to me this kind of shows the orbital perspective, in that this is a picture of Afghanistan. And it was a picture I took of Afghanistan when, there was some pretty significant fighting going on the ground. And if you look at this picture, it looks so peaceful and beautiful. And if you think, just below those clouds, there's, we're squabbling over, things that just don't seem that important when you're in space. And, so again, this is what I really like about this one. And again, you have the shadows on the thunderstorms down there, and you can see the pink as the sun is starting to set. And it's and again, you can get the perspective of where the sun is, where the Earth is, and the moon. And the only thing that I wish there was in this picture were the stars, which you really can't see even when the sun is up.
Wow. Hey, guys, I don't know if Jim, is your mic working yet?
No, I don't think he's working right now.
Okay, he's typed a couple of questions, or he's typed a question in the chat window here. So I got a question for Ron on how the cameras were mounted in microgravity.
Well, we would either hold them in our hands, or we had these brackets, that we call them Bogan arms, that would clamp onto a part of the space station, and then we could just move them anywhere, any different orientation that we wanted, and they held the cameras very still.
Did you try any they sell like a lens skirt that you put up against the window to keep the glare off?
Yes, we did the Space Shuttle Endeavour brought one up and we stole it from them.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Ron, can you recharge batteries on the ISS, or did you bring up just a ton of batteries with you?
No, we recharge them. We go through them pretty fast, especially when we do the time-lapse stuff, because we're taking 400 or 500 shots at a time, and it burns the batteries, burns through them pretty fast. But we have chargers.
again, whoever's like the commander of the ISS at that moment, and they're monitoring the amount of electricity that's being used, they're like, who's been recharging their camera again?
It's all solar energy. We have more solar energy than we can use. So it's great.
That's right.
So, Ron, I can't imagine the feeling that you get when you're all the way up there, and just like you talked about the shot of Afghanistan, how, and I think you're doing stuff with Fragile Oasis with this, but, I mean, I can't imagine that feeling, and maybe you can talk a little bit about it, of seeing this fragile oasis below you, and there being so much conflict and so many problems that we're facing, and now this global warming. I mean, how do you react to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a sobering contradiction. It really affects you when you see how peaceful and beautiful and fragile the planet is, and it really does, like I said, make everything that we fight over seem so insignificant, and you know, some of the inequity that's on our planet, it just seems so much worse from that vantage point. And, you know, it kind of filled me with a call to action, you know, to kind of make a difference. And I think that we all can. I mean, and so there's a lot of projects that we're working on right now to try and make a difference. And the secret, I think, is you know, being able to work together and to kind of team up to tackle these problems. And I think that's, you know, part of the legacy of the space program. We have 15 nations that came together and built the International Space Station, some of which we're not always the best of friends, and that is probably one of the greatest engineering accomplishments of all time. And you know, if we can do that by working together, imagine what we can do to solve a lot of the problems facing the planet. And so, you know, I think that's something that we get from the space program. We also get the idea or the fact that nothing is impossible. You know, if we can go to the moon and back, if we can build a space station, anything's impossible. And then we get this orbital perspective. And now that we have these new cameras, and the cameras are getting better all the time, as you guys know. You know, we can share it better, and I think, you know, the more emotion that we can put in the pictures, the more emotion that we could put into the time-lapse photography, and by emotion I mean being able to really share the experience, I think the better off we're all going to be, because I think we get on some level, and maybe even a deeper level than we had before, this feeling that, you know, each one of us is riding through the universe together on the spaceship we call Earth, and we really get that feeling. When you're looking down at the Earth, you really get that feeling, and it's very sobering.
I can't imagine.
Trey, are you back with us?
Yeah, but my connection is so sketchy, y'all. I apologize, and I'm really enjoying listening to this. I want to see also everyone else's photos.
Yeah, I wanted to be on the show so I could learn stuff from you guys. So, I was told you were all going to tell your secrets.
How much time you got?
Well, let's start left and right, shall we? Should we start with Ben and have a look at some of your pictures and tell us a bit about them?
You got to be kidding me, man. I mean, Ron, what you've done in your free time on the space station is so incredible. To put any picture up in this conversation just feels ridiculous. But sure, yeah, hey, why not? Let's start the ball off with the guy who takes pictures of the roar from the space station.
It's a bit like being at a party and you're trying to chat up a girl or something. Some guy comes along and goes, "Hey, I'm an astronaut." And you're like, "I'll go home. What can I do? How do I follow that?"
No, that's not really fair, because I mean I was very, very fortunate to be in the place that I was. I wish we could send poets and musicians and real photographers, and you know, we have amazing cameras now that are basically point and shoot for the most part. They're really easy to use, as you guys know. And you know, if you guys were up there, the pictures would be 1,000 times better. So, and I'm not just saying
that. You guys are doing such a great job at sharing that stuff, though, now, Ron. You know that, you know, in the past year or a couple of years, not only has the imaging got better, but the sharing's got better. It's so much more open. You feel like you can engage with NASA, and, you know, the pictures that you're taking are, you know, it's really nice to be able to see those. So,
hey, good job. Can I ask you guys a question? Because this is something that's really difficult on board. You know, you don't have a lot of time. You're taking a lot of pictures. And it's very difficult to keep track of them all. It's very difficult to identify where they are. And when you share them, it's a really, you know, it's really good, you know, whether it's Twitter or Google Plus or whatever you're sharing it on, because we have the internet up there. What I'd like to do is I'd like to create an open source, repository of pictures where we could dump all these pictures and have, you know, some crowdsourcing on them where people can take them, they could post-process them, they can identify them, they can categorize them, and then we would be able to use them, you know, near real time while the guys are on board. So as they downlink the pictures, we can send them to two places. We can send them to NASA, but at the same time, we can send them to, you know, whatever this repository is, which would be open to the public, or maybe to maybe select people in the public, however we want to work it, where we could start, you know, basically having people come along as fellow crew members on the mission. What do you guys think about that? Is that feasible, or is that something that you think would be worthwhile?
I think it's a killer idea.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Heck, I'd process your images.
Trey could use them for his homework assignments.
Yeah.
I mean, I think any of us would want to process your images and help distribute those. You know, it's just the plan of it's just getting it together and getting an email address is what I think. And that way, I mean, I think you guys have enough to worry about up there, but if you were able to send it to one of us, I mean, especially Trey with all of his followers, I'm sure that people that follow him would love to see those kinds of pictures.
So then we could, you know, the pictures would come down, and then when you guys get a picture that you really like, you've identified it, you've post-processed it, it becomes this masterpiece, then we send it back, we email it back up, and then the astronaut on board can send it out through social media and identify those people who did the hard work on it, mm-hmm. and really, you know, start sharing them that way.
That'd be awesome.
Mm, it's a great idea, and also even if we could get involved in the, hey guys, could you take a picture of this? I don't know if there's any opportunity to do that. You know, if we could sometimes maybe even have some input into some of the subjects or timings or things, then you know, leave you guys to do the really complex stuff. You can offload the some of the compositions or subjects. We can suggest some of those if that makes it easier. We've upset Ron so much he's gone. Unless he's gone to implement it already. Ben, here's your chance. He's gone.
No, it seems like a good chance to start sharing photos.
Share those photos right now.
All right. Let's start on the left. Let's see here. Actually, guys, I just got back from a weekend in the mountains and was part of a group of friends. We made the first igloo ever that I've ever worked. Oh, that doesn't look so good on the screen, does it?
It's not bad.
Not so bad. So it's not a great shot, but literally just pulled it off the card and put it up online. So we made that igloo this weekend, and there's stars above it. I had like an hour of clear skies. But something more along what I like to do is kind of here's another weekend out. This was last year, kind of stars and mountain and tent. So, and then one
it's
more.
Beautiful.
Ron, this one's. I kind of feel like you might like it. It's not space, but I really appreciate the effort you go to find interesting viewpoints and kind of connection with story and stuff.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Awesome.
Thank you. I kind of went to great lengths to try to find a context that can sort of put the stars off in a new way. So I'm loving these old houses with the stars.
Oh, I love
stuff.
That. Mm-hmm. That is awesome.
Thanks, bud.
So
just saying, I really appreciate all the effort
there?
You go to. What's that?
Did you put a light inside there, Ben? Was it abandoned and you put a light inside?
Yep, it's abandoned. There's a couple lights, lanterns, headlamps, all battery-powered, so no fire hazard. But funny story, around 4 a.m. I went in there to get the lights out, and there was a giant porcupine in there. I almost, like, literally tripped on, and that thing freaked me out. I was so scared, like, I couldn't even scream. It was one of those, like, silent screams. It was just, like, just, like, slowly went freaking out of the house. So something always interesting happens in those abandoned houses.
Yeah.
That is the worst thing about astrophotography, is the scary sounds at night.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. The animals.
No one warns you about the scary sounds. Go out and take some pictures at night.
I think I have that in a disclaimer.
I have no qualms with being a tough guy going out at night shooting. I get scared all the time. But hey, real quick before I pass the ball, Ron, I got a text from a really heavy time-lapse shooter, Jay Burlidge, and he said he'd love to post-process your space station shots anytime.
Cool.
So
cool.
I think the collective photo body would be honored to be involved in that kind of concept in any way.
All right, well, I'm gonna try and set something up, and if you guys have any ideas along that route, let me know, because I think we're going to try and do that.
That'd be cool.
That'd be great.
We'd love to help out.
Hey, Brad, should we hand it over to you now? Okay. You nailed some of the best lunar eclipse photos that I saw
last year.
I'm not sure if you got the moon rolling down the mountainside. Yeah. Just everything came together.
I can pull that one up real quick. Give me a second. Well, let me start with this one. This was probably my wait. Where's the screen share? Do you see that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. So this is probably the most popular one or whatever out on the web. This was NASA's astronomy picture of the day taken in Arches National Park. This is double arch, and like you said with the eclipse, it just takes hours and hours of planning these shots. Definitely not something I do in my downtime, Ron. And to plan this Milky Way, to put that right up against the arch, to have that clear night sometime in May, which was kind of rare, but it just all works out. And then the distant monoliths in the background of the image too was just something that all worked out really well. And one thing with this image in particular you have to fight with is light pollution. And Arches National Park, that used to be one of the darkest places in the world, but Moab, Arches is getting more popular, and you got Canyonlands next to that with a whole bunch of other national parks. And Moab's growing, therefore light pollution is growing. So who actually knows how long these kinds of dark skies will be in the Arches National Park? It's kind of scary.
So Brad, are you illuminating that with hand lights, or is that kind of...
Yes, I am. That was a light painting. And another light painting one that I'll show here, this was during the Orionids meteor shower.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
And this is a composite.
Wow.
I don't know how well you can see those meteors at the top, but this was probably the most difficult, scariest shot I've ever had to do. I don't know if you guys have ever shot very close to waterfalls. It's not very fun. It's slippery, dangerous, all the above. But what was good is I didn't have creepy sounds to freak me out in the middle of the night because it was so loud. but it was really cool. But yeah, this was a composite. This is not a single frame, which most people think. So basically just took a bunch of shots throughout the night, and I wish I could have turned it into a time-lapse video, but there were so many breaks in the shooting because I had to wipe the lens off because of all the spray that was coming from the falls.
Hey, so you shone a light on the falls, on the falls then, did you, for that?
Yes. Absolutely.
How long are you doing that for? How long are you doing that for, typically? I mean, is it just a little burst?
I wish I could tell you. You need to play with it. I mean, it depends on how much ISO you're using. It depends on what your aperture is. It all depends on the exposure, because sometimes you do it too much, and then it gets too bright, and vice versa. I'd say a good start was maybe only like 5 seconds for a 20-second exposure.
Hey, Brad, let me say something to put something in perspective, because I think you brought out a really good point in that, you guys, the perspective that you have is that you think of a shot, you plan it, it takes hours to plan it, you have to have everything perfect, and you get the shot. Whereas where we are, the environment that we're in, we have amazing shots presented to us, handed to us on a silver platter every second. And all we have to do is snap the picture. And I could give you, let me share one of these with you real quick, because this is a perfect example of being at the right place at the right time. So,
how?
So, I mean, this is digitally blown up, but, The stuff like this happens all the time, where you have the auroras and you have the city lights and everything else, and all we have to do is just stick a camera there and capture it. So it's, you guys, you're doing it a lot harder than it is for us, because we have these things handed to us by the second.
Yeah, I appreciate that, yeah. And I'm sure any one of these guys can testify to that. I mean, it just takes so much timing. Because, it's kind of like, I mean, imagine a photographer going out to a lake and waiting for that perfect sunset, And something like that, it can happen.
Of them every day.
Love saying that, don't
you? That's great. But I mean, imagine, you know, you got kind of one big subject to work with, whereas what we're trying to do is we're trying to put that big subject together with another subject that is just so far away, and we're trying to align that with something else. You're right. And a lot of people, sometimes they get it, but sometimes they don't. And I mean, it's hard for me to answer all the questions that I get when I get emails of people just asking, how do I shoot like that? And it's hard for me because I wish I could teach you, but it'd probably take, you know, 6 hours or so. I don't know if you can see the shot that's on my screen now.
Yes, we can.
This one I did for the gallery in Mount Shasta for an opening I had. And to find this spot to shoot the Milky Way with Mount Shasta in the foreground, I don't own a four-wheel drive vehicle, which I really need to invest in. But I actually got stuck up on the mountain just trying to scout and find a location because, you know, in these forests, there's so many trees that there aren't too many openings to have a clear view of the night sky. So once I did find this, it just happened to be that perfect time of year. And it's interesting, too. There's a lot of haze in the bottom of the image where there was a forest fire going on near the Mount Hood area. And that's another kind of thing that we always have to work with is just Mother Nature and what she's producing, too.
Awesome.
Cool.
So,
Dave, may I ask, do we only have 5 minutes left on this show, or do we keep going?
I said we keep going, because everybody needs to show their shots, so. And Jim, you're right, doesn't work.
I think it's,
okay, good.
Brad, if you, I think we should just check if Jim's mic's working, because he's not said anything to us this evening. Jim, are you there?
I've been trying, trust me.
There you are.
We can hear
there we
you.
Go.
Yay, I don't know why.
I love your book, by the way, Jim. I bought your book, it's fabulous.
Thank you very much. I actually had another question for Ron there, which was, I know that being a scientist and being an astronaut and being out there, it's fantastic to capture things as they appear, but one of the things I've always wondered is more of the abstraction of the subject. So, for example, standing in the middle of the desert while I'm doing night photography, I'm thinking, what would it be like to be a satellite spinning in space and taking a long exposure? What would space look like at that point, and how weird would that look? So I was wondering if you go out there next time, or maybe I missed it in some of your photo stream, are you taking any abstractions of what you're seeing, like a long exposure in complete orbit?
I have not done that. I think Don Pettit, who's on board right now, does some of that. But no, and certainly if I had the opportunity to go again, I'd be doing a lot of different experimentation and seeing, again, because, you know, you're trying to capture the experience and the emotion of being there and share it.
Well, I would imagine part of being an astronaut is being back on Earth and kicking yourself with, why didn't I think of doing that?
Right.
At some point.
Right.
Hey, Jim, since you're on and your connection's working with us, do you want to take this opportunity to share some of your photos?
Assuming it still works, I'm more than happy to. let's see. Screen share. Is that working?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's sure beauty. Is.
Okay. Yeah, this one is, just because it's randomly taken, this one is on the racetrack in Death Valley, and there's still some light pollution there, but it's still not as bad as in other areas within California. And so this is a multi-image stitch of the Milky Way arcing across the sky. I actually had more in the scene, but stitching software is still tricky and limited, so I'll rework this at some point and include Jupiter in the upper right-hand corner.
How many exposures is that?
You know, I don't remember offhand, but it's probably, I think I overkilled this, and I had probably like 14 or 16, and I ended up omitting maybe half of them. So I think it's about 7 or 8 images, and they're vertical images.
That looks fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
That's good.
So we were talking about abstraction. This one is taken with a Canon 8 to 15 millimeter lens that I got from borrowlenses.com, and they were kind enough to give it to me. So the light streak at the top is actually a car driving by, and that's on one side of the valley. And then towards the bottom, the highlights here is actually the starlight shining off the desert floor. And basically this is 100% view of of the night sky. So I was
so is that a number of exposures that you stacked, or is that a single exposure?
Yeah, no, that is. I just set this up and let it run until my battery died. So I think it ended up capturing about three and a half hours.
Wow.
Of the night sky. I'd have to double check, but I think that's about right. And I've had a lot of people comment to me that this looks like a thumbprint. Which I don't think is that far off, because I think at different places within different places on Earth and at different seasons, you would get very unique signature of star trails. So it's not that far off. Let's see.
So Jim, just while you're queuing up your next picture, you say that's about a 3-hour exposure. Could I ask what ISO and what F number you're using for that? Because that's a pretty dark sky not to blow out over that length of time.
Well, it is pitch black. I'm doing this when there's no moon in the sky. Let's see here. I'd have to remember exactly what it is. Let's see. No, I don't have it on this one because it's a composite, but I have a feeling it's no less than ISO 1600, and it's more likely going to be ISO 3200. Is what I'm thinking based on my memory of it. And is the next one showing up for you guys?
No. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. So this one again, I can't remember the principle, but it's basically this concept that really, if the sky is full of infinitely of stars, then wouldn't the sky be white? And I think that our eyes don't adjust to it, but your cameras can. And so this actually I just set up outside of my tent and let it run while I was asleep.
And, that doesn't count then.
What's that?
I said it doesn't count then.
It doesn't count. What are you talking
about?
You
can't be asleep. You can't be asleep.
It was freezing. Yeah. I had to stay warm. for the most part, this is kind of they call it ecliptical star trails. You can actually see the ecliptic plane, which is where the star plane is a straight line. And it just so happened at this time of year, even as far north as California where I was, you can still see the bending in the stars at each pole. It's one of those things. I wish I could have the widest lens that would have worked for this. It still did. I think this was at like 16 millimeters or something like that. So just shy of being in a fisheye. I thought it came out pretty good. I like the artistic nature of it. A lot of people feel that the star trails are too overpowering, but again, if you think about it, all those stars are out there. Technically, the sky could be white if your vision was sensitive enough. How quickly are the images refreshing?
Right away.
Very quick. That looks great.
Great. Yeah, so this one's Mobius Arch in the Alabama Hills. And most people shoot the opposite direction on this one. They shoot Mount Whitney and whatnot. And I decided to set up for about 7 hours. And I was awake during this one. I was sitting in the middle of the dark waiting for this to go through. And this was hundreds of 30-second exposures. And I kind of blended it with a sunset shot. So that gives it a little bit more of the glow on the rocks and the color in the sky.
Love the abstract nature of that one.
Yeah, thank you. And this, again, is the racetrack, but actually I'll mess with this one. I've always wanted to do a reflection shot.
Oh, cool.
Of star trails. And I kind of, the wind picked up, so the reflection's kind of washed out, unfortunately. So there's a little bit of Photoshop magic here with the star trails, but I still think that it has a great impact, and somewhere out there there's a reflection that's waiting for me to get in camera.
I wanted to ask all of you guys, one of the things I really love about your Star Trail shots and all the ones that you show is that you really integrate the landscape into them beautifully. I'm just so unimaginative. I point the camera straight up. I don't even try and integrate anything else. And there's such an they look so fantastic when you get like those arches or even a man-made building with a eclipse perched on the top. I wonder, do you use any software that actually tells you when is a good time for an astronomical object to be in a certain place at a certain time of year? Or is most of it just potluck?
I use Stellarium quite a bit to figure out where the Milky Way is going to be and the moon and on a certain day or night or a certain night.
Yep. I use a really good app I just discovered. It's called Starwalk. It's only $2.99 for iPhones from iTunes, iTunes App Store. And then there's also a good app called Star Map. That one, I believe, is either $9.99 or $10.99, and a whole lot of Google Earth.
Yeah. I wrote a blog post on night apps that I use, and the ones that have been the most useful to me have been Go Skywatch, because that one's actually got an augmented reality thing where you can actually point your phone in the sky and actually identify objects. And I do plan, and the foreground elements are extremely important. Even for Ron, you have to get some kind of foreground element to give you some kind of bearing as to where you are. Otherwise, I think it's too disorienting for people that haven't been able to experience that moment. And I think it also adds a certain degree of drama. TPE is a good one, the Photographer's Ephemeris.
Jim, what was the first one you said?
Go Skywatch.
Thanks.
And that one's really cool. I don't know that it would work too well in space, though.
hey Jim.
Awesome.
Jim, I just, your photos are tremendously artistic, but I think that there's probably a scientific value, if not scientific, an educational value, I think. I mean, those would be really good pictures to use in an astronomy class to show, like you said, the ecliptic and the relative motion of the stars and be able to translate that to the motion of the Earth. And that is really amazing.
Oh, thank you. I'm honored that you like them so much.
One of the themes that's coming through on all these pictures, and obviously if you're into astrophotography, that getting dark skies is really important. I wanted to ask all of you, maybe don't give away your true secret locations, but if somebody, let's just do North America at the moment, because that's where most of you guys are. Whereabouts in North America is the best dark sky for you? We'll start with Ben. Where's a great location if people want to go somewhere truly, truly dark?
I try to let people know that I usually drive 2 to 4 hours outside the city to get the star shots. And out here in Oregon, we're really lucky that once you go outside that radius, it's really wide open. But if I can make a trip out to southeast Oregon, that's like heaven for me. I mean, it's wide open, it's low light pollution, it's glorious. So that's my spot.
How about you, Brad?
Pick me up on the way, Ben.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you can pick me out here.
For me, that's an interesting question. I on the PCT, I went through all kinds of different terrains, and even when I was up in the middle of the Sierras, up at like 10,000 feet, 100 and something miles away, I could still see Fresno in the distance and that giving off light pollution. So for me, I've been kind of traveling all around, but Oregon and Northern California have been pretty good to me. There are also some really great spots in Utah too, but like Ben said, I would recommend anyone just start driving. Yeah. And when you don't see a single city light somewhere, that's a good start. Mm-hmm. and then maybe even drive some more.
Yeah.
I always have this thought in my mind. I wish I could create some kind of dock or plank or something out in the middle of the ocean, so I could be just right in the middle of the countries and not get any kind of light pollution. Ron, you need to work on that with me, okay?
Yeah, you can. You throw stones.
You got friends who know people. Come on now.
Hey, Daryl, yeah. Where's a good dark spot?
Obviously, Northern Ontario. I've gone fishing up there, hundreds of times, literally. I've never actually photographed up there because, like I said, I just started. Last summer I started seriously taking photographs. But it's about a 12-hour drive to truly get away into what they call a zero, light pollution zone. Good time now just to do a quick little thing. What we mean by light pollution is if you ever look out, you know, look out your window, on, especially on a cloudy night, you can see it. You'll see kind of a glow on the horizon. That's actually what's known as sky glow or light pollution. When we talk about a dark sky, we're talking about where you have zero light pollution, zero light from the moon. So that's, you know, if you're looking to see the Milky Way, if you get to an area that's actually a true dark sky location, there are people that have mistaken the Milky Way for dawn. You know, that's how bright the stars get. But just to let everybody know, this was actually pointed out to me by a fellow G-pluser. There is a map overlay for Google Earth that will actually, it's a light pollution map.
What?
So you can actually find, I haven't used it myself, I've yet to find it. But what I'll do in the next little while, especially I've got everybody here in my circles, so I'll when I find out exactly, I'm going to talk to the guy that I talked to about it. It's an overlay for Google, you know, kind of like a plug-in, and it will actually show you a light pollution chart so you can, and it goes by different grades.
Is Derek, can I chime in on that?
Yeah, go ahead.
If you do a Google search for Dark Sky Finder, it'll bring up a website, and it has that light pollution Google map overlay.
There you go.
So not the website, but just Google that Dark Sky Finder, and that'll bring it to you.
Perfect.
Correct me if I'm wrong, I think that was based on census, correct?
Is that like a population density thing?
I think it was. I mean, kind of the formula, I think, makes sense, but I think that was what it was for.
Okay.
But in any case, it's a great start, absolutely.
Yeah. And if any, all these apps and stuff that you guys are mentioning, it'd be great if you could put them on the stream so that people can find them. I'm just talking about me selfishly here. Jim, I noticed you nodding when people were talking about Utah as a dark location. Isn't Bryce Canyon, well, that's not, is that, I'm not even going to show my state ignorance, but isn't Bryce supposed to be one of the darkest places? They've got a sign saying it's really dark here, I think.
Yeah, I think the southern portion of the state is considered one of the darkest, the areas with the least amount of light pollution in the country. I wish Death Valley was as dark. That's a little closer to me, but it's an amazing place to be. I think it was kind of made subtly earlier in one of the comments, but I think it's really misleading to people how much light is actually naturally there in the sky. People just can't believe it, and it's really unfortunate that there's so much light pollution. People just don't realize that the ambient lights of just their homes can create so much pollution in the sky. I actually, just to plug an organization that's used some of my images in the past, the International Dark Sky Association, they're actually out there trying to preserve and educate people to, you know, the importance of having a dark sky. It seems kind of something you take for granted, but once you realize what's there, you realize how much you're missing.
So Randy, what about you? Is it, and also anybody who lives in a city and is now feeling disheartened that they can't go out and do any long exposure stuff because they live somewhere with a bright sky. There are ways around this, aren't there? There are light pollution filters, you can use shorter exposures and stack them, but do you want to talk about that and also your favorite dark locations?
You know, I've tried shooting where there's some light pollution, but you know, you always end up with that orange glow in the sky and you really can't get rid of it. But I mostly shoot in western South Dakota. But I've shot out in Utah and southwest Colorado is really good. Canyon of the Ancients area. And up in Wyoming is really good. You know, you just get as far away from the city lights as you can. You know, within 100 miles or more, you know.
So, well, sorry, I shouldn't say 480 millimeter. That's what the focal length is. It's an 80 millimeter f/6 apochromatic triplet. This shot here is probably about 42 minutes of photography. It's stacked. Probably each shot is about 180 seconds, and they're stacked together using a free program called a Deep Sky Stacker, and then you do post-processing in Photoshop. But that's the type of photography that I originally got into. I'll show another one here quick.
So, Daryl, for the people who
this is known as the Seven
Sisters. Why do you do lots of individual exposures and stack them instead of one long one? Could you explain that?
The best way to explain it, you want, first of all, you want the ability to use different exposures for on M42, the last one that I showed. If you just did one big long exposure, that central part would be absolutely blown out. There would be no detail in it whatsoever. So it allows you to kind of do that. It's almost like an HDR. The other main reason that I do it as well is something as small as a gust of wind can ruin your shot. So if you've got, you know, say it 45 minutes into the shot, and then all of a sudden a little gust of wind comes up and shakes your I have a 20-pound tripod that I use when I do this. So, you know, if something comes up and shakes it, you've lost that amount of time.
Or if some pesky astronaut in the ISS goes past your field of view.
I've never had that problem. I think that would be totally cool. You do get satellites that fly through every once in a while. Again, sometimes if they're cool enough, you can leave them in, or you can just edit them out, leave that shot out. This one here that you're looking at is actually the Seven Sisters. From Earth, it looks like a tiny, you know, looks like a tiny dipper almost. You'll see it, I guess it would be right now, pretty high in the sky when it gets dark, but it looks like a little, that's about, you know, how you'd see it from Earth. Again, this is about 40 minutes of photography stacked. So yes, that's the type of photography I really enjoy doing. Since joining G+, the likes of the guests here have gotten me into trying my hand at some of the landscape or the star trails. This one was actually just taken the other night. I don't know if you can see it here yet.
Yep.
There we go. I drive by this area. This is about 10 minutes away from my home. And for those of you that you know, that are watching that talk about light pollution, down in the right-hand corner, the high-tension towers are leading towards that city. That light that is being produced there is from a city that's probably about 40 miles away. So it does affect. It worked in my benefit in this case because it lit up the towers. This is probably about...
Well, those towers, those towers is what's making the light.
Yeah. It's nice to kind of leaps towards the problem, isn't it?
That's a pretty good statement right there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This shot, there's kind of a bit of a funny story to it. I almost, this is a whole bunch of, you know, 30-second exposures stitched or put stacked as well. About 45 minutes into shooting this, the Ontario Provincial Police actually came up, and I was afraid they were going to shine their lights and blow out my nice black foreground, so I actually started running towards them and then turned on my lights, so I had to save the shot, because that's the type of things you deal with when you do long exposures. Mm. If I had have had a break where, you know, I couldn't use those frames, you would have had a break in the star trail, so it basically would have ruined that shot. And this is one of the darker nights that we've had in some time, so... Get another.
It's funny. I usually hide in the bushes when the cops show up.
I don't mind. I've got a buddy who's a police officer, so I just, you know, you throw his name out.
Nice.
This one doesn't show up all that well. This is just a pier in a little town called Port Dover. This is across Lake Erie. You know, if I kept going across Lake Erie here, I'd eventually run into I think it's Ohio. But this is just, it wasn't a super great night for photographing. One thing that hasn't been mentioned in the hangout here is when you're photographing stars and you want to see more of them, there's actually a few factors. There's you know, obviously the clouds and stuff like that, your light pollution, but there's also something called seeing. And what we mean by that, I don't know if anyone's ever walked outside and looked up at the moon and you've seen, you know, a halo around the moon. Well, that's a bunch of ice crystals. You know, those types of things affect how you see stars or how many stars you see. This shot here could have been a lot better had I had a better night for quote unquote seeing. So you know, there's a lot of factors. It can be a lot more difficult than people think sometimes to capture these images. Okay, that's enough for me. I will unscreen share.
Cool, those are awesome pictures. Now, in the chat on the Twitch chat, there were some people asking who dropped in and out of it there what kind of instruments you were using. So most of those deep sky ones were prime focus, which is just a complicated word for putting your camera straight on the end of the telescope to
set
an eyepiece, right?
Yeah, I can quickly go through it. I've got what they call a German equatorial mount.
Do you have a photo of your setup? Do you have a photo of your telescope with the camera on it?
Oh, you know what? I do, actually. Give me a second.
I love the gear shots.
You love gear shots? No.
you guys go ahead and talk. you guys go ahead and talk, and when I find it, I will...
Can I chime in with the website while he's looking? Another one for finding good spots to go shoot at is cleardarksky.com, and there's a whole list of observatories in the U.S., and it has fantastic charts that kind of talk about the transparency of the night, the visibility, the light pollution, and all that other thing. So if you're not sure even where to begin, a good way to begin is looking at these lists of observatories that are in your state. And that website is cleardarksky.com.
Yeah, I use that all the time.
Yeah.
Hey, Ron, you mentioned dark skies in Texas. Check out Big Bend National Park.
Big Ben, okay.
Yeah, very dark skies there. I shot a few time-lapse sequences there, and just plan your trip right. Mine, I got the Milky Way rising from the horizon, which worked out really cool, but I had to twiddle my thumbs for half the night. But really great place to go and go camping, too, definitely. Yeah.
Thanks.
Wasn't Big Ben just designated as an international dark sky park now?
It should be on that list. I don't know. I have not heard.
Yeah, the International Dark Sky Association, they've been working to set aside places for sky viewing, and then they work with the municipalities to kind of control the light pollution in the area so that lights that are put forward have different protection things to not cause more light pollution. So that's exciting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Yeah, we've got
okay,
one up
here as
well.
Okay, let's hand over to Randy.
Okay. Let me get it up here.
Hey, Randy, did you ever get a chance to introduce yourself?
No, I didn't. My mic wasn't working then. My name is Randy Helverson, and DakotaLapse.com is my website. And I shoot mostly time-lapse, but I also get the astro photos out of it, too. For some reason, my window's closed.
Screen sharing can be quite a challenge.
Well, yeah, I'm doing. I got the window open, but I don't see it on the screen share.
You usually have to have it open beforehand and then choose it.
Maximize it.
I have it maximized.
Yeah, you have to have it open before you click the screen share button.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah.
Okay, can you see that?
Nice.
Beauty.
Yeah.
That's the shooting star that Ron shot from the space station.
Yeah.
Hey, maybe Ron could actually throw things down and see if that thing create a few things. So Ron, we're ready.
Just throw your memory card down, Ron. I'll take care of the rest.
That's actually, it's a meteor I shot last October, and the moon was just a crescent, and it was starting to go down, and then the Milky Way is just to the left of the moon. And the meteor hit, and then it formed a persistent train, which it looks like a smoke trail, but it's actually ionizing gases, and it lasted for about a half an hour through the time lapse. So I caught that whole process. It last just a few seconds on the time lapse, but it was pretty interesting.
Well, that was.
And it's in my new time lapse that I just put out a week ago.
Yeah, well, I watched that time lapse. What an amazing sight to see.
Mm-hmm.
That's way better than any science book. That was incredible.
Yeah, and, I caught one, about a week earlier, too, but it was a lot shorter, and it was right on the edge of the frame. And, those are the only two I've caught, but I caught them within a week of each other.
That's incredible. How long did it take for the score to be written?
It only took Bear probably maybe three or four days, I suppose, to score it. But he was busy, you know, doing other TV shows and stuff. So I was kind of at the end of that list, I guess.
Brad.
Well, I just heard that Randy held on to his footage for a really long time. And
yeah.
I don't think I could have done that.
Yeah. Well, I had the whole time lapse pretty much shot by the first part of November, end of October, you know.
Wow.
This was close to the end of where I was shooting when I shot this.
Wow.
So, yeah, I held on to it for quite a while. But, you know, to wait for him to write the music for it or score it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Randy, in this shot, is this all ambient moonlight or are you using a secondary light source?
You know, I do have a lantern to the left and kind of back from the camera. But, you know, at this point, it's probably more moonlight. But once the moon went down, then the lantern, the LED lantern, lit it up.
Kicked in, yeah.
I had it hanging up about 10 feet off the ground, about 50 yards away. And, you know, it kind of lights up the grass. And even the trees, you know, that far away, it would light them up some.
Yeah, it's a great balance, Randy.
And then this is one I shot in the end of December out in the Badlands. It's, can you see this one?
Yeah.
It's a frame from a time-lapse, too, and, you know, there's real high, thin cirrus clouds, so it kind of makes the stars pop a little more. You can see, like, Orion, it almost magnifies them, I guess.
Yeah, it halos them beautifully.
Yeah, the halo, you know, just makes them look big.
And it's funny because those clouds, normally when you have high cirrus clouds, it's a nightmare when you're doing like deep sky or a big view, but on time-lapse they look really great because they're moving across.
Yeah, if they're really thin, you know, it makes them kind of a cool effect. And then this is some aurora that I shot last October, at the end of October, in Wisconsin. Is when there's that big storm, is like October 25th.
Yeah.
You got fantastic colors there.
Yeah, it was so bright you could see your shadow on the ground from it. I mean,
it's crazy.
The strongest I've ever seen. I don't.
Well, that red is a rare color, right, for the aurora?
Yeah, it's, you know, from what I've seen, the majority of them are green, but I think the higher
intensity,
the more intense they are, you get the higher. Maybe the higher ones are red. The higher
that's
the
correct.
Altitude.
Yeah. Red is higher altitude.
Mm-hmm. And then this, I shot this in August, I think it was, and I lit up this whole area with two LED lanterns. It was, you know, there's no moonlight at all that night. And actually right here you can see a deer.
Nice.
And these sunflowers are probably only 2 feet away from the lens.
Beautiful.
And then this is an old house. This is in my new time lapse too, and the camera just sits down into the field. You know,
wish I could take these kind of shots from New Jersey.
Yeah, and this is actually just a still.
That's why I left.
Dave, would you leave your camera outside at night?
Yeah, leave it out for about 3 to 4 hours, and then I pick it up, go back and pick it up later. And for this shot, she had to stand still for the 30 seconds.
Nice. Looks like she's smoking. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's about all I got.
I've got a photo of my setup there if you want to see it.
Shoot. Let's see.
Okay. Now, there is I quite often will use an old pillow cover to keep the dew off, as well, you know, you can do all sorts of other tricks, but that's just one little trick. So it is kind of hanging over the front of that. So this funky looking thing on the front is actually the thing I use to keep the dew off. There's my setup. Again, a carbon fiber Apple Chromatic triplet, DSLR hooked in. That little silver disc thing with the wire running out of it is actually an auto guider. Once I pull or align it, I just use that to make sure that I don't get any drift, or, you know, make sure that it remains pointed on the star. Now, the thing about these German equatorial mounts is, for those that are watching, is the key to using one of these is you have to get it exactly aligned with the Earth's axis, so that as the Earth spins, the camera and the scope spin along with it. Otherwise, your stars will wind up looking like eggs. This keeps perfectly crisp, you know, nice round stars, and you can do 2 hours worth of photography on a subject and not get that smudging. So
this is something I find fantastically difficult in the Southern Hemisphere, because there's no convenient pole star there where you're aiming. It's just a big, big blank space. And they go, oh, it's easy. It's just a magnitude 8 star. Just point it. That's about 5 degrees away. That's fine. I've never managed to do it. My deep sky career is over since I moved to New Zealand.
Gordon, do they not have, if you look at the very cone of that that tripod, there's actually a little what they call a polar alignment scope. Mm.
Yeah,
do they not
sell
those for the Southern Hemisphere?
They do. I've got a Losmandy GM8, and I've got the polar alignment scope for that. For anyone whose eyes are glazing over now, this is a little kind of like a monocular that has got little stars overlaid in it and a little light that lights them up. And the idea is that you use it to align your telescope at the pole. But honestly, like, in the Northern Hemisphere, you have a load of really good pointers, but in the Southern Hemisphere, there'll be like two right next to each other, all miles away from it, and that means you've got to kind of draw a triangle that goes like this, and it's so, so difficult to get right. So I've given up. I've given up with high-power lung exposure stuff. It's too... I envy you guys up there now. It's really up there in the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah, but you've got those gorgeous Magellanid clouds down there in the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, that is also, that is true, and they're so bright you can actually nail them with like 30 seconds at 1600 ISO on a normal camera lens. They're huge.
Those are incredible.
I just want to thank Ron for coming. He's got to take off. I know he's got a time constraint. So thank you very much, Ron, for coming on the show. We appreciate it. It was great.
Oh, you betcha. Thanks for having me. This has been awesome, and I've been watching your guys' pictures, admiring your guys' pictures for a long time, and I'm going to continue to do so. My pictures stopped coming, but you guys are still coming. So. But we'll be in touch, because I really like to get you guys help and guidance and advice on that crowdsourcing idea that we have to get the pictures off the space station and out to the public a little faster. So sorry I have to drop off, but it was great hanging out with you guys.
Thanks, Ron.
Anytime, Ron. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you.
Nice meeting you.
Take care, guys.
Take care. Bye.
I'm sure it's the same for other people, but I would say the photos may have stopped from Ron, but the inspiration hasn't.
Well, he's got another, what, 24,000 to share with us. So.
Yeah.
I was so
now that Ron's gone, I don't feel so bad about sharing mine. mine are pretty late. In fact, this is terrible. You know, you guys are out of politeness, you know, but I mean, it's like mine are terrible, so I'm going to skate through them really quick. I mentioned earlier that I really like, can you see that picture?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I really like Earthshine. And this is an easy picture that you can do with normal equipment. This was taken... So when I'm talking about Earthshine, for anyone who's not into this, it's where you wait for the crescent moon to be really, really thin. Really, really thin. Almost like that one that Ron showed earlier. Not quite as thin as that. And what happens is if you overexpose that, you actually begin to see the rest of the moon illuminated by Earth. That's light that's reflected off the Earth. And because so much of the Earth is blue, the light reflected is blue, and that's called Earthshine. I think I've got that reasonably right. And it kind of looks a bit like an eclipse shot in a way. Here are four different views that I took with a 300mm lens and a normal DSLR. I think there are a couple of second exposures. So actually there's a little bit of motion there. We were talking about the rotation of the Earth that you need to counteract to stop blurring. Here I didn't. It was on a normal tripod, and you can see there's a bit of motion blur. But that's meant that the clouds have moved a little bit, and it felt like it was almost sat on the ocean a bit in a way. Well, that's what I thought. Moving on, we've not done much high power stuff, so here's a high power shot of the sun, and that big black dot isn't a sunspot, that's Venus, and this was a transit of the sun. This was taken with my telescope, which is a Teleview Genesis, which in lens terms is a 540mm f5.4, So in telescope terms, you talk about the aperture. So it's a 100 mil or 4-inch aperture. But in lens terms, it's 540 mil, 5.1. This is what you'll get with a 2x teleconverter, so it's kind of double that. So, I mean, it's, Venus is...
It's the original beauty spot.
Yes. And the cool thing about transit is, obviously, what you can do if you're an explorer of hundreds of years ago is you'd sail to the other side of the planet to witness and time this in order to work out the size of the universe and all the rest of it. But I just use it as an opportunity to get a little kind of Pac-Man bite outside of the sun. So that's a close-up of Venus going over the limb there.
That's great.
And it's a really cool thing to watch.
Nice.
How fast did it move across the sun, Gordon?
Oh, faster than you think. You know, it was like a few minutes.
Wow.
I mean, it wasn't moving. It wasn't a few seconds, but it was a case of a few minutes.
Yeah.
If you turn away from it and go back, it had moved quite a lot. And I wanted to get a picture where the Venus was just touching the edge, the shadow, and I missed it. But this was during the day, and I took this from a balcony of my one-bedroom flat when I was living in London in the middle of the day. Obviously, you need solar filters to do this kind of photography, yes. And we can talk about that on the stream later on. Don't muck about with this sort of thing, because you will blind yourself and potentially burn out your equipment as well. Mm-hmm. So you do need proper solar filters. But once you've got that, it's all good. Here's another solar shot, and this shows some really big sunspot group. Let me try and find that. Where did it go? It's down here. Darn thing.
A little more to the left. Left and up.
Yeah, I think you're right.
No, not right, left.
I'm just going to zoom out. There it is.
Who's on
there
first?
There it is. Yeah. There it is.
Oh.
Yeah, it's on the side, doesn't it? Come on. There it is. Look at this. Look at that sucker. It's huge. So if Ron was here, he could tell us how big that is. I'm just going to glibly say, that's bigger than the planet Earth. You have to do it in that voice as well.
Billions.
Years ago.
Billions and billions.
I'm only going to show one long exposure.
Oh,
jeez.
Beautiful.
Thank you. This is Comet McNaught. I've shown this before to anyone who watches Trey's Hangouts and has caught me on it before will go, wait a minute. This guy's only taken 10 photos, and we've seen them all now, because you've seen this one before, but it's one of my favorites. This Comet McNaught was a small comet in the Northern Hemisphere. By the time it was visible down here, it turned into this epic comet that was massive, absolutely massive. And this was taken from a ski resort in Queenstown, where I live. The light that you see in the bottom middle of that picture, that is the light pollution of Queenstown. It's actually quite considering it's such a small town, the light you get from it is quite bright. But this was, as I recall, with a 24 mil lens. I think I can confirm that later. But that shows you how big that tail was. And if you brighten the exposure on this, the tail goes all the way and arcs like 180 degrees. It's like a protractor. It's massive. And you'll see two tails there as well, depending on, I think, what is it? One's gas and one's solid. Is that right? Something like that.
Or I just want to really quick say thanks to Jim for coming by. Appreciate it, man.
Thanks, Jim.
Amazing,
thanks, Jim.
Fantastic talking to you guys. Always enjoy your photos, but never had a chance to really talk to anybody. Just always one-sided. So a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Nice to meet you, Jim.
Cheers.
Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Moving on, this is my last picture. This is a lunar eclipse. And what you can do, this was again taken with the 500 millimeter telescope that I've got. And it's quite nice when you are taking these pictures that you, instead of just aiming for, because when you first get into taking pictures of the moon or the sun, you get a bit depressed because you think, wow, I've got a 300 millimeter lens, that's huge. But when you point it at the moon, it's tiny. Then you get a 500 millimeter lens and it's still small. Then you put a converter on it, it's 1,000 millimeter and it's still not filling the frame. And that's when you think, wow, this thing is so bright. It's so deceptive. You know, the sun and the moon are really little. You need massive lenses to capture them. So one way around that is to just show different phases of the moon or a different phase of an eclipse like I've done here and do a kind of composite shot. So this was an eclipse in New Zealand about, I think it was 2007. The one last year I didn't get because it clouded over, but this was the last one I managed to capture. I did, however, there's a schoolboy error here. I don't know if you guys can see it. Can you guess it yet? The clue is, look at the orientation of the moon. On the first two, I've clearly not moved the camera. And then during the eclipse, I got bored and took pictures of something else, put the camera back on again, and, of course, it had rotated. I rotated the camera, as I rotated by almost 180 degrees. It's terrible. And that's a really important thing. I think you guys can obviously talk more about this, that when you are doing any kind of astrophotography, whether it's quick exposures like this or long exposures, you've got to be so careful with your equipment not to move it, to keep things consistent, because you can get really caught out. And this was just a really silly thing that during totality, I think I moved the telescope to take a picture of something else, and that was dumb. Because if I'd realized I was going to do a composite like this, don't touch anything. Leave everything the way it is. But I blew it. But I still quite like the composite there. So those are my shots.
No, those are great. And Gordon, I got that eclipse photo for you too, just because you asked. This was the one with the eclipse moon rolling down Shasta.
Nice.
That is fantastic.
That is awesome.
And the one reason why I really like this one was just because it was single frame. No HDR, no multiple exposure, just straight out of the camera. And that was kind of the really nice thing about it, is that there wasn't any kind of post-processing have to do with this image, which was really nice. Mm-hmm. Also, for everyone else who is still left listening to us, Ben and I, we were organizing a landscape astrophotographer circle, and I still got that going, so I'll definitely post that with the addition, of course, with all the talent that's on here, and everyone else can check that out, and hopefully we can share that away, and enjoy.
Yeah, hey, Gordon.
Go for it.
Just one thing. It's one of the things I did with G+, because... like I said, I've learned so much from all the photographers, you know, these gentlemen here with the you know, their Star Trail shots and Milky Way shots have just, like, got me pumped and everything like that. I started showing some of my deep sky photography, and there was so many questions that I actually decided to start a little group. So it's kind of a shameless plug here, but so I've got something going on Google+, Astrophotography 101 group. And I give tips, tricks, and homework assignments. For instance, to let you know, started out with shooting the moon. You know, that was assignment one. And it's actually being, you know, pretty well received, and it's nothing that, you know, is rushed. It's been going for a few months now, and we're still on assignment two, which is shooting very quick, you know, star trails. So for anyone out there who's interested in learning about it, you know, I won't profess to be, you know, to call myself a master. It's a very steep learning curve to do astrophotography. I'm still learning, but I'm sharing as I go along, you know. So anyone that wants to come along and enjoy the ride with me as we learn together, I'll share what I can. So
Dal, is that a G+ page?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's Astrophotography space 101 space group.
That's cool. I mean, what I thought we could do now, I've got to head off myself soon, and I'm sure, I don't know how many people are left watching. I mean, I'm loving it, by the way. I can
hang out all night talking to you guys.
Yeah, I'm really, really loving it. But I thought what we could do is, again, stop from left to right and just say, you know, we've been showing all these kind of advanced techniques, but if you could just give one astrophotography tip, like for somebody who's got normal equipment, either in terms of location, maybe exposure settings, equipment, any kind of tip that's, you know, because let's try and get people out and doing this. That doesn't involve them, you know, freezing their ass off or by sitting out all night long listening to scary animal sounds and having the police drive past. Ben, your top tip.
A lot of questions I get is people asking, how do you focus on the stars? And one of the easiest ways to do that with the newer cameras, if you have live view, is crank your ISO as high as it'll go, turn your live view on, and point your camera to the brightest star that you can find in the sky, and then zoom in. Usually on your live view, you'll notice a fuzzy spot of light. And if you zoom in on your live view and use that live view to turn your focus, bring that fuzzy spot to a pinprick, then your lens is set to focus on the stars. And pull it out of live view mode, go back to your regular settings, and now you've got good focus on the stars.
Now, Ben, when you do that, you're using the screen on the back of the camera, right?
Yep.
Have you ever tried it via a laptop? Say, like, if you're using a Canon, you could do it via the EOS utility, you get a bigger screen, or...
Yeah, Tether would be really nice. I usually end up in some pretty far out there places, and so I haven't brought the laptop with me. I really wish the iPads would work as a live second monitor for that reason.
But yeah, I believe if you had it tethered, then you could definitely zoom in a lot better than just the back of your camera.
You can do that with certain Android tablets with an app called DSLR Controller. You can do the live view and control the camera and all kinds of stuff with it.
It's only certain
phones and certain tablets that have the USB hosting function. But it's an awesome app.
It is really cool. I mean, that's the most frustrating thing about using a telescope instead of a camera lens, is that the telescope is manual focus only. Mm-hmm. And I shake quite a lot. And when I'm turning the little wheel to adjust the focus, the image is doing this. Whereas when you're using an autofocus lens and you've got it connected, you know, via, say, the EOS utility, if you're using a Canon model, you can just nudge that focus back and forth remotely while you're looking at a magnified view of it. And that is so nice to be able to nail that focus. That was always the biggest challenge for me prior to live view and computer control. I love being able to do that.
Yeah. Huh. It's pretty cool with the second monitor idea.
Brad, what's your top tip?
Know your location. As I said before, you know, we're scouting these locations days, probably months, sometimes even years before. Know where you're going and know what you're getting into before just picking up your camera gear and heading out in the middle of the night.
Are you talking like in terms of physical danger? Having a rock fall on your arm and having to saw it off?
Well, you know, you never know. I mean, if I went to the waterfall area where I shot the Orion's meteor shower, and I went there without knowing anything about the place, and I was there with just a headlamp and a flashlight, I would have gotten in a little bit of trouble, definitely. I mean, just out of pure safety, know what you're getting into. You know, like hiking up to Delicate Arch in Arches National Park, you have nothing but Karen's guiding the way. You don't have a clear marked trail. And if I didn't scout that place before, who knows if I would have been able to get out, and it would have been a cold, miserable night up there.
Any potential animal attacks?
No, never. I mean, and, you know, when I was on the PCT, I really got used to animals, and, you know, I had my bear experience in the Sierras and mountain lion and stuff. And, you know, read your basics and go over, you know, just stand tall, don't run, and pray.
Yeah. Darryl, do you have a top tip?
Actually, I was going to say the same thing as Brad about knowing your location or even setting up the shot in the daytime. But other than that, the number one thing I can say is have fun doing it. I mean, go out there, experiment. It's the best way to learn. You know, get out there, take 10-second shots, 20-second shots. You know, see what kind of result you get. The only other thing I do is during your experimentation, find out what your camera's sweet spot is with the ISO. You know, crank it up, you know, as much as you can. Play with your aperture, you know, settings, because each lens is going to react differently. Mm. Each lens is going to have a sweet spot. So, again, just don't be afraid. You know, there's lots of information out there on the Internet to find out how to do this sort of thing as well. And just have fun with it.
Join Darryl's page, obviously. That's the main one.
Yeah.
Randy, have you got a tip for us?
Yeah, I get, a lot of people have trouble with, like, dew or frost getting on their lens, especially if they're shooting time-lapse. What I do is I take the disposable hand warmers, and I put it on the bottom of the lens and strap it on with, like, a rubber band, or some people use a Velcro strap, and that's all it takes, and it'll last, 6 hours, and keeps the lens a little bit warm, just to keep the dew and frost off of it.
So, Randy, for anyone who's not experienced this, it's the same as like when you get up early in the morning and you see
they look like these. Yeah. I think that's what they look like.
Yeah.
Hey, when you said you were going to show me pictures of hotties on the internet, I was
like, Brad, was it you that made the post about that?
No, it was Randy, actually.
It was Randy? Okay, I knew
and I thought it was brilliant. I didn't think of that at all. I had the same problem when I was shooting these.
They sell the lens warmers, but then, you have to deal with extra batteries and then, the wires and, you can buy a lot of hand warmers for what one of those costs, too.
So, Randy, I think some people watching might not know why this is a problem. I mean, it's the same thing as when you wake up in the morning and you see all the dew formed on, like, flowers and things. That's effectively happening on your lens, isn't it? And and you'd be taking these pictures without realizing it, and the front of the lens is just covered in water, and you're thinking, why is nothing appearing on my picture?
Yeah, it'll just get foggy and you won't see anything, you know, once it does that.
So the solution to that is to either, what, have some sort of extension, like a lens hood, or heating, yeah?
Yeah, what I do, just take, you know, one, the hand warmers, and put it on the bottom of the lens, because assuming, you know, the heat rises, and it'll just kind of keep it warm enough and burn it off, I guess. It does, you know, it doesn't get so hot it's going to hurt the lens or anything, but I've been doing that for a couple of years, and it's been working good.
It basically keeps the condensation from building up, because it's not cold, so there's nothing for the condensation to build up on.
And, you know, I used it down to, like, 10 below, too, and it keeps the frost off.
That's awesome.
Actually, Dave, it's your turn now.
Shoot for the moon.
Gordon, if I can I'm just going to throw one more quick tip out there for people, just because what Randy said kind of really reminded me of something. That dew forms when your lens barrel's colder than the outside. So what happens quite often, if anyone shot outside quite a bit, if you walk in with your equipment, it's going to fog up on you. One little trick that I use, and I actually have it on the astrophotography page, is I take a cooler with me, and I throw my camera in the cooler, and I just bring it in the house, let it warm up inside the cooler. That way you're not going to risk getting mold and all that, you know, the nasty stuff that forms in your lens when you get condensation in there.
How about leaving your gear outside a bit? Say if you're shooting in your backyard, should you leave your gear outside for a couple of hours, prior to shooting?
Yeah, anytime you can, your gear is going to perform the best when it's acclimated to your environment. When you use you'll know this, Gordon, because you shoot through a telescope as well. About perfect, or about where you can get, is about 2 degrees warmer than the outside. Any more than that, and this is kind of what scared me to use the hotties with the telescope. On the lens, it shouldn't be so bad, but when you get into a telescope, you can actually get convection currents inside the tube. So I'm going to try the hotties to see if they work, because that's a heck of a cheap way to do it, because those warmers are pretty expensive.
Yeah, they do all those little accessories that just attach on and warm it up. And
if you've got a warm lens and you're trying to shoot in a cold environment, you're going to get convection current. So yeah, if you can acclimate your lens slowly to the cold, and then when you bring it inside, acclimate it slowly to the warmth, you're going to be far better off.
Dave, I feel bad we've not included you too much here.
That's right.
I kind of followed Trey's previous lead and, you know, talk to us.
I think you can also use Ziploc bags to get it acclimated instead of a cooler barrel. I think you can try that too if somebody doesn't want to carry a cooler around. Just pop a Ziploc bag in your pocket. If you're going to come back inside from a cold environment, put your lens in the Ziploc and then let it warm up, and then take the lens out.
Oh, there you go.
I've also heard that
too. Cool. Well, I think, should we wrap this up?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Sounds good.
This has been fantastic. I really enjoyed it, not least because Trey wasn't here and I got to take over. So it feels like a megalomaniac. And I hope it's not upset too many people.
It's like when Regis takes the week off and the guest host comes in. You know?
Yeah, that's right. Should we just quickly run through? Tell us where we can find your pictures. Ben, how do people find you?
Find me on my website, thestartrail.com.
Brad.
Google+.
And you can find me on goldpaintphotography.com. And Google+, of course.
Daryl?
Google+.
That's Darryl, easy. Dave?
Ben, you can find me on Google+ by going to plusdave.com.
Randy?
DakotaLaps.com, and I'm also on Google+.
Cool. You can also find me on Google+. I'm Gordon Lang. I'm editor of CameraLabs.com. That's where you'll find me. And as soon as I've finished talking to you guys and had some dinner, I'm going to post some high ISO comparisons with this G1X. So if this is a camera you're interested in, check that out. I thought I'd use that plug shamelessly, though. I hope you approve.
Thanks for having us, guys.
Thanks so much. Right. Thanks so much, everyone, for coming on. Thanks to Ron, Garen. I don't know about you guys. It was such a... Well, I think we were all in awe. It was like, it's an astronaut. It's Ron.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. To share so much time with us. That was great. And thank you, Trey, for getting us all together. I'm sorry for hijacking it, but I hope you enjoy either the live show or the recording.
Yeah.
Cheers, Trey. Right. Thanks.
So everybody, wave goodbye to the camera.
Good night, everyone. Thanks for joining us.